National news from a grassroots perspective. You're listening to Groundwire from coast to coast to coast.
What has happened in many ways to Canadian history is a kind of ethnic cleansing of our history.
I'm basically here because, well, this story needs to be told. And I'm totally here to support this neighborhood especially.
You're working this whole time, getting maybe 4 hours of sleep, trying to do your job so that you can bring your money home and feed your kids.
Welcome to Groundwire, brought to you by the National Campus and Community Radio Association. This week's episode comes to you from CJSR in Edmonton. I'm Steve.
And I'm Sam.
And we'll be your hosts for the next half hour of grassroots news.
Today on Groundwire, we have a report from Vancouver on the Poverty Olympics, organized to draw the attention to social issues that organizers say have fallen by the wayside in the race to the Olympics. We also hear from victims of police brutality who spoke at the Forum Against Police Violence and Impunity in Montreal. And Afua Cooper tells us about the history of slavery in Canada for Black History Month. But first, here's the headlines from campus news outlets across the country.
Contract negotiations between the University of New Brunswick and its full-time faculty union may lead to a strike or lockout. According to the Canadian University Press, the Association of the University of New Brunswick Teachers has been without contract since last June. Since then, after conciliation talks concluded, a new collective agreement has not yet been reached. A joint press release by the university and faculty union stated that, quote, both parties share the goal of supporting the communities around us and of making UNB a better place to study and work, end quote. However, further details on the negotiations may not be found, as both parties have agreed on a complete media blackout on the issue. In the meantime, UNB students are left to speculate on what a strike will mean for them. Sarah Ratchford explains.
Many students are not even aware that this is going on. The ones who are, they're quite anxious, and they're expressing that other students are confident it'll work out. I think it's a mix, but I think it depends on when an announcement is made about what exactly will happen. I think if it is announced that there's a strike, obviously people will be protesting, much like they did at the St. Thomas strike a couple of years ago.
The UNB negotiations continue while other college faculty in Ontario and at St. Francis Xavier University in Nova Scotia recently rejected their university's final offer. Reporting for Groundwire, this is Annabelle Koo from CHRY in Toronto.
You're listening to Groundwire, the grassroots news from across the country.
In the run-up to the Olympics, many BC groups have decried the massive expenditures on the Games. They say the money could be better spent on social programs, particularly given the poverty and drug addiction in Vancouver's downtown east side. To highlight their concerns, activists organized the Poverty Olympics. CITR's Andrew Longhurst caught up with the Poverty Olympics torch relay as it wound its way through Vancouver.
The 2010 Poverty Torch arrived in Vancouver's downtown east side on Sunday, February 7th for the opening of the 2010 Poverty Olympics. As the Poverty Torch entered into Canada's poorest neighborhood, coming all the way from West Vancouver and across the Lionsgate Bridge, the crowd grew considerably. Activists, organizers, residents of the downtown east side, and Canadian and international media prepared for the torch's arrival. As the torch neared, one of the organizers spoke to the crowd, highlighting the goals behind the Poverty Olympics, which has been held since 2008.
The reason why we're here, and the reason why we're so committed, and people have pushed that torch around the province, and people have dressed up, and they're going to put on a mini Olympics today, is we want to raise welfare.
The Poverty Torch arrived at the Center for the Vancouver Area Network of Drug Users, which was one of a number of community groups supporting and organizing the Poverty Olympics and Torch Relay. The handmade Poverty Torch, pushed on a hospital gurney, made its way down East Hastings in style, with music, dancing, and numerous signs reading, End Poverty Now. As we marched to the Japanese Hall, the location of the Poverty Olympics, alongside the torch, I asked people why they were taking part in the Poverty Olympics. I first spoke with downtown Eastside resident Floyd and asked him why he was attending.
The whole thing is I really, really wanted to check it out. I'm not really for or against the Olympics. I really don't know because it's not really going to affect me in any way. But apparently it's affecting a lot of people here. So I was very just once in a lifetime, because the Olympics, I figured this was the whole reason why the Poverty Olympics came anyway, so I figured I'll check this one year out and then really see what it's all about. It's just probably just some harmless fun, is protesting, yeah. And it's not really, they're not out to really like hurt anybody, and they're just having their moments, and that's about it.
But while he admitted he wasn't for or against the Olympics, every other person I talked to expressed their frustration and anger over the games. And what's your name?
It's Tash.
And why are you here today?
I'm here to support the people in our community who are not being supported by the Olympics and who remain invisible amongst all these games.
And for you, what does the Olympics represent?
It represents a lot of greed, a lot of corporations, money that is being claimed to be spent on the city, a lot of initiatives that would not have been supported if it wasn't for the games happening, a lot of lying, and just a lot of people being invisible, and the fact that there are a lot of Olympic promises, like supported housing initiatives that were supposed to happen that have not happened, and it looks like they'll never happen, and it's really sad.
And what's your name?
It's Kat.
And why are you here today?
I'm basically here because, well, this story needs to be told. And, I'm totally here to support this neighborhood, especially because we're on the downtown east side. And I have a work that actually supports people in this neighborhood. And they've been forced off of their livelihoods because of this. The police presence in this neighborhood has increased. There's $1 billion that's going towards the police presence in the city right now. And, I just figure that, you know, I need to do the most I can to get their story told.
I also spoke with Mary Ann Neal, president of the Burnaby Teachers Association. As she carried the association's banner with other teachers, she told me how angry she was that public schools are facing significant funding cuts, while the public cost for the games has been estimated to be around $6 billion.
I'm the president of the Burnaby Teachers Association, and as everyone probably knows by now, the education system is being drained of funds this year while they spend millions to dump snow on Cyprus. So as a result, the children of BC are going to suffer so that we can have 2 weeks of celebrations that most people can't afford to participate in. So that's why we're here.
I even had the opportunity to speak with one of the 2010 Poverty Olympics mascots. What Poverty Olympics mascot are you?
I'm Chewy the Rat.
Chewy the Rat. And why are you part of this Poverty Olympics protest?
Well, you know, me and my entire family, there's millions of us, we all live in this neighborhood. And we love it when landlords provide bad housing because there's always garbage and bad upkeep and all that, so my family can thrive just fine. Sorry about you people.
After a 20-minute march through the downtown east side, we arrived for the opening ceremonies. After an Aboriginal welcoming and statements by organizers, the Poverty Olympics MCs, Chewy the Rat and Itchy the Bedbug, introduced the events of the Poverty Olympics. The games including housing hurdles, a miracle on ice, and wrestling for the community. The events represented political satire at its finest. As VANOC CEO John Furlong and BC Minister of Housing Rich Coleman were impersonating competing in a hockey game against ordinary British Columbians and putting their dirty tricks on full display. Following the Poverty Games, I spoke with Vancouver City Councillor Ellen Woodsworth, the only city councillor to attend the Poverty Olympics. She has been a very vocal critic of the official Olympic Games and saw the Poverty Olympics as a way of calling for a national housing strategy, as well as greater provincial support for social housing.
I think it's very important that we stand together with community groups and citizens and say if we can raise over $6 billion to host the Olympics, we can continue this and raise $6 billion to end homelessness and provide affordable housing for everyone in this country.
The 2010 Poverty Olympics is just one example of how some Vancouver residents are opposing the 2010 Vancouver Winter Games.
That was Andrew Longhurst from CITR in Vancouver reporting on the Poverty Olympics in Vancouver. I'm Sam.
And I'm Steve. And you're listening to Groundwire, a production of the National Campus and Community Radio Association.
Next up, Voiceprint brings us an interview with writer Afua Cooper on slavery in Canada. Cooper discusses the cultural amnesia that is prevalent among Canadians when it comes to the history of slavery in this country. Cooper is author of the highly acclaimed book, The Hanging of Angelique.
Slavery in Canada was a tragic episode in this country's history. It is also a forgotten part of this country's history. Why so little focus on slavery in Canada? What is at the root of this country's amnesia regarding slavery? Afua Cooper is the author of the acclaimed book, The Hanging of Angelique. VoicePrint's Marjorie Nicolau spoke with Afua Cooper about this disturbing part of Canada's past.
Many people don't know or don't want to know that slavery actually existed in Canada. You know, Canada had the reputation as a haven from slavery, in fact. For example, Underground Railway comes to mind. You know, why is this so?
We always want to see the good in us and to highlight that and to celebrate that. And there's nothing wrong with that. But it's a kind of, we're tricking ourselves when we do that. What has happened in many ways to Canadian history is a kind of ethnic cleansing of our history. So we talk about the Underground Railroad, especially in regards to the settlements in the province of Ontario, and you know, some Underground Railroad population also in Quebec and the Maritime provinces. But we don't talk about what happened to these people once they got to Canada, the discrimination that they suffered and how they struggled to make life. And we don't talk about the slavery in Canada that preceded the Underground Railroad period. We don't talk about the 1,500 black loyalists that set sail from Halifax Harbor in 1792 for Sierra Leone, West Africa, because they were promised land by the British after they fought in the American Revolutionary War on the side of the British Crown. And when they got here, you know, the old white masters wanted to reenact the same kind of race relations that they were used to, that were prevalent in the United States. And these black loyalists said, no, we fought for the crown. We are loyalists. We were promised these things. It's not forthcoming. We've been treated shabbily. We're out of here. And they sailed on 15 ships to Sierra Leone, West Africa. We don't hear those stories. That, too, is a very riveting story. We don't hear that. We just tend to highlight the part of our history that makes us good. But there's something wrong with that. There's nothing wrong in learning about our past, in learning who we are in its totality. We should. When we talk about slavery, we point to the United States constantly. But under both colonial regimes, the French and the British, the enslavement of Africans, the enslavement of Aboriginal people, was a normal thing. It was a fact of life. And I think it's a kind of Canadian thing where people get upset when you talk about what they consider to be our unsavory past, which is kind of silly. So because we, you know, we as human beings, we are good, we are bad, and we're ugly. And we have to embrace all those facets.
Yes, that's reality. But so you're suggesting that it is a form of denial.
It is a form of denial. And I find it's even more dangerous than... it's a form of denial. It's racist. And again, we point to the United States, you know, the big bad republic. Of course, in the republic, that discussion is on the table. So I think it's even worse in Canada because we can't discuss it because it hasn't happened. The level of the discourse is very low. We're in denial. So how can we discuss something that never happened that we keep denying? And that's extremely dangerous. And it's not just from lay people. You find this in our institutions of power. You find it in academia. You find it among many historians who feel that they have to protect the past. You know, historians are guardians of the past or see themselves as such. And many establishment historians feel they really have to guard the gate and not let certain kinds of knowledge float through or float in.
That was an excerpt from an interview with writer Afua Cooper, provided to Groundwire from Contact, VoicePrint's flagship interview program. To hear this interview in its entirety, please visit their website at voiceprintcanada.com or call VoicePrint at 1-800-567-6755, extension 226.
Ladies and gentlemen, back on the...
Aboard!
This program for Black History Month recounts the unfair working conditions and prejudice faced by railway porters in Canada and their struggles to win fair employment rights.
Who will be? Oh,
yeah. Who will? These people who contributed to the development of this country, but their history was unwritten.
Who will be?
Being a thieving car porter, we were at the bottom of the economic and social ladder. I first started on the railroad from Toronto to Vancouver at 22 years of age. It was a breathtaking experience across this country to see the mountains and then the Fraser River way below. But after 14, 15 years, I got tired of it.
He was a World War II vet, fought for democracy, marched with the liberation troops, got home here and had to, you know, experience this.
Airline hostesses, dressed in a glamorous-looking uniform, they were looking after the welfare of passengers in the same way that we were looking after the welfare of passengers on the railroad. But we had to shine shoes. You got your shoe shine kit, and you paid for it out of your first paycheck. Black brush, brown brush, every night. I did that for a period of about 8 years, summer and winter, both at the CPR and the CNR. This is what we had to go through in order to put ourselves through college.
When we talk about the job itself, like making beds and cleaning latrines and cleaning up the spittoons and worrying about inspectors being reported on the train, those sorts of things, they went on. Like going to the dining car and having the curtain which separates you from the rest of the passengers. You getting a lower class of food than the passengers, even though that you're working this whole time, getting maybe 4 hours of sleep, trying to do your job so that you can bring your money home and feed your kids.
When the passengers get on the train, they would say to the porter, "Oh, you're George Pullman's boy. How are you?" And then it was reduced to, "Oh, you're George's boy." We're never men, you know, always boys. The American inventor of the sleeping car was George Pullman, and he decided when he had his sleeping cars built that he was going to use all black men on his sleeping cars because they had just recently been emancipated from physical slavery, and he figured they wouldn't ask for too much pay. We worked up to 400 hours a month or more. We had no maximum hours for the month. We just worked whenever the boss wanted you to. And if you were 23 hours and 59 minutes late coming in, for purposes of bookkeeping, you're on time, no overtime. And the only time we got overtime pay is if the train was 24 hours or more. And for 24 hours late arrival, we got a day's pay, 8 hours. 16 hours of work was free for the company. And of course, we had no rights that management was bound to respect. If a passenger complained against the porter's actions, the passenger was always right.
I was with the VIPs. I was with the Prime Minister, and I was with the Governor General, and I was with the Queen 3 times, Queen Elizabeth. What was used to complaining? You get no satisfaction from nobody until the union came in 1956. That made all the difference.
The Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters for the first time gave black Canadians a national black voice. We had porters in the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters in Vancouver, in Edmonton, in Calgary, in Winnipeg, in Montreal, and Toronto. And of course, it's the first time that black men sat on one side of the negotiating table and all white men sat on the other side of the negotiating table to consummate a collective agreement in the history of this country. There was history that had to be told. How did things change? Well, we had hours reduced from over 400 hours a month to 240 a month. Every minute the train was late, 23.59 minutes would be 23 hours 59 minutes overtime pay. So it was a national organization which made it as effective as it was.
And out of that portering experience, we've got people like Oscar Peterson. These were people whose fathers worked as porters so that they could do the job that they wanted to do, which was not working on the train, so that they create music.
The railway porters heard were Stanley G. Grizzell, Neville Gray, and Marcel Lord. The two additional speakers were Selwyn Jacob, film producer for The Road Taken, and Clifton Ruggles. Thank you for listening. I'm Noel Thomas.
On the ground, in your community.
Groundwire is a listener-supported project of the National Campus Community Radio Association. Support community radio news. Support Groundwire by donating now at ncra.ca.
Montreal activists say that the police have become de facto street judges, with the power to convict and execute their suspects on site. In an effort to build solidarity between people dealing with and organizing against police violence, social justice activists recently held Montreal's first ever Forum Against Police Violence and Impunity. CKUT's Candace Cancanet and David Cook were there, and they bring us this report.
About 300 people attended the Forum Against Police Violence and Impunity, a weekend-long event that took place from January 29th to 31st in the Montreal neighborhood of Park Extension. Organizers adopted a strict no police policy for the event, saying that people victimized by police violence should feel safe speaking out without fear of reprisal.
The CKUT News Collective was there to document the forum. We reviewed hours of audio, but for this feature, we only had time for selected highlights. We hope that, in the spirit of the event, it brings together the powerful and often poignant voices of those dealing with and organizing against police violence on the island of Montreal.
In the gymnasium of the Park X Community Center, family members of individuals killed by police sat together and told their stories. Here's Bridget Tolley, an Algonquin woman from Kitigan, Zibi, Anishinaabe.
I am the daughter of Mrs. Gladys Tolley, who was fatally struck on Highway 105 by a patrol car driven by two Sûreté du Québec police officers on October 5, 2001.
She explained to the audience that the inquiry into her mother's death was conducted by the brother of the officer who had been driving the patrol car that struck Gladys.
His brother made a report and said, the first factor of my mom's death was negligence of a pedestrian, and the second factor was alcohol. This is the brother of the cop that just hit my mother. Only an investigation fully independent of the police can satisfy that there is no bias in favor of the authorities and to ensure that the truth comes out.
That was Bridget Tolley. Najla Benes is one of the sisters of Mohamed Anis Benes. At age 25, Mohamed was killed by Montreal police shortly after he left a mosque after morning prayers in December 2005. Police say they were acting in self-defense after he threatened them with a kitchen knife, but his family says that this explanation is far-fetched.
Que mon frère qui normalement va se tasser de la rue parce qu'il y a des fourmis pour ne pas les écraser, qu'il aurait abattu.
She says, my brother, who would normally go out of his way to avoid stepping on ants on the sidewalk, could he have attacked a police officer? That doesn't fit at all with his character. So to find out what happened, we have demanded a public inquest into his death, and 3 years later, the coroner finally ordered such a public inquest. But the police fraternity made a plan to block it, insisting that there's no reason to have a public inquest and that it's just a waste of money.
Pour dire qu'il n'y a pas lieu d'avoir une enquête publique et que ce n'est que du gaspillage des fonds.
On Sunday at a panel called The Gender of Police Violence, we heard about how sex workers are treated as second-class citizens in the legal system that allows violence against sex workers to go unchecked. Here is Anna Louise Crego, who coordinates Outreach for Stella, a group run by and for sex workers, and fights to decriminalize their lifestyles.
In the court process, women are attacked, told, you're just a whore, you wanted it, you can't say no, prostitutes can't get raped. And so at a number of the trials this year, we stood outside and asked for support of other people to stand outside and let the women know that we're outside, and we believe them.
Jessica Yee, founder and executive director of the Native Youth Sexual Health Network, talked about the violence of a law enforcement system rooted in colonialism.
The recognition of the laws that police are supposed to uphold in justice systems as colonial imposed laws, I think lends itself to an interesting discussion about the types of justice that we want to see. I think for us as Aboriginal people, we need to know the Indian Act inside and out, but we also need to know that so long as we're still living in this colonized imposed state, that we are going to need allyship and support and all peoples as part of this struggle.
That was Jessica Yee.
So how can people defend themselves from police violence and harassment? Well, to start with, you need to know your rights.
Cops are going to ask you lots of questions, they're going to tell you lots of things, and you'll want to respond, you know? And even without thinking about it, some of your responses might incriminate you. If you can, remain silent. Under arrest, you're only required to give police your full name, your date of birth, and your current address.
That was Marique from the Collective Opposed to Police Brutality. She led workshops over the weekend about how to deal with the police. The weekend ended with a hip-hop concert featuring groups including Micro Almé. So we end this report with one of their tracks entitled Montreal.
Réveille-toi, guerrier, sommeillant dans l'ombre, observe une pause. Puis regarde autour de toi, aussi loin que ton regard se pose. Il te faudra agir, ne dépose pas les armes, il n'est jamais trop tard. T'endures dans la ville, puis ton quartier difficile. Aucune échappatoire, chevauchant la mort, dans une coupe fragile vers l'espoir. Ou ailleurs, au coin d'une rue, attendant le destin. Je te dirai au Montréal, rien n'est dur, sauf de vivre. Montréal, rien n'est dur, sauf de vivre. Je te dirai au Montréal, rien n'est dur, sauf de vivre. Rien n'est dur, sauf de vivre. Une porte s'ouvre, leurs armes foulent leur noirceur. En elles s'écoulent, drogue et liqueur. De rancœur saoule les prises d'école. Dormir sous la pluie, oublier l'école, se nourrir d'alcool. Et les gens évitent leur visage, ils évitent leurs yeux. Car oh Dieu, la ville se meurt, ils ne savent pas pourquoi. Va, préviens tes frères et tes sœurs. Qu'il faudra que dans leur cœur émane la grandeur. Le sort en est jeté, à présent plus de liberté. Rien que des mensages frappés sur des pièces de monnaie. Mais on n'est pas sans ignorer que partage et compassion de ce que Dieu a rejeté.
From sunset to sunrise, Tuesday, February 23rd and Wednesday, February 24th, community radio stations across Canada will be broadcasting this year's Homelessness Marathon.
It's like homeless is a label, which means you are something different, but these are regular folks. They have come under hard times or different situations, just like anybody else, and they may not have had family around to help them.
The main focus of this event is to provide an alternative perspective on the subject of homelessness. For 14 hours from coast to coast, airtime will be dedicated to giving a platform to advocates and those experiencing homelessness firsthand.
The marathon just has such a diversity of voices, and there's so many panels, there's so many topics covered, whereas in the mainstream media you kind of get snippets, and it's definitely not ever the focus of mainstream media. It's more of an occasional blip in mainstream media, whereas really this is 14 hours that are completely dedicated to talking about this really important issue.
Major cuts in government funding in certain areas, especially those relating to the arts, put more and more people at risk.
Artists in general now within British Columbia are getting the short end of the stick with a reduction of funding by 90% over the next couple of years.
Some statistics put the number of homeless people in Canada as high as 300,000, almost 1 in 100. With such levels of extreme poverty, the lack of coverage is alarming to many Canadians.
The Homelessness Marathon is great because it really allows the people that are in that community to express their stories with very little mitigation. So folks are going to get an opportunity to really hear the stories coming directly from that community and not maybe interpreted through through a more mainstream kind of filter.
The Homelessness Marathon, a look into the lives of homeless men and women across the continent.
We want to kind of, I think, spotlight and outline all the issues that face homeless people in these communities. Specifically, I think we can look at the interesting dynamics between that Canadians versus Americans face with health care and access to health care. So we're excited to interview folks on both sides of the border and bring these stories to the airwaves.
And that brings us to the end of this week's edition of Groundwire. Groundwire is a project of the National Campus and Community Radio Association. Today's episode was produced by CJSR in Edmonton with contributions from stations across the country. Thanks for listening. Groundwire is a national grassroots news program. To sponsor an edition, email groundwirepitch@ncra.ca. For their support, Groundwire thanks the Public Service Alliance of Canada, performing quality public service on behalf of Canadians. To learn more, visit www.psac.com.